Yeah, I was planning a very different sermon today, and the sermon I was thinking of giving, I was thinking about last night when I was watching the news, and the news that's coming out of Egypt, of the riots that are taking place, it was unprecedented. It was mentioned on the news by the actual, not the interviewers, but the newscasters, that it was an unprecedented time that is actually taking place currently in Egypt with the riots and the fact that Mr. Mubarak is very, very, I mean, I can't really see him surviving. If it doesn't happen this time, it'll certainly happen in the very near future. He's 82. And the interesting thing is that if you think about it, of all the people that Mr. Armstrong saw, you think of the Shah of Iran. Well, I mean, you know, quite frankly, when you think of Mr. Armstrong going around the world actually seeing all these individuals, you almost feel that if you were prominent like that and you had this invitation or had this request to actually come and see you, you'd think that it was the kiss of death because, quite frankly, you know, look at Anwar Sadat. He was assassinated. The Shah of Iran was deposed. Mrs. Gandhi of India. Again, shortly after he'd seen her, the Sri Lankan leader, I think he actually was toppled. Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, Kenyatta of Kenya. You know, one by one, shortly after he had actually seen them, they were deposed. They left office. They whatever happened. They in fact were no longer the power that they had been, and the entire country was taken into a different phase of its existence. Certainly, the Shah of Iran is a classic when we look at that, and what's happened with the Ayatollah Khomeini, who actually came into power at that time, and then all the way down to Ahmadinejad at this present time. But two individuals, that doesn't actually occur. Now, one of them was King Bhumibol of the Thailand, and he is now 83, and the other one was President Mubarak, who for 30 years thereafter reigned. And now what we're looking at is the chaos that is in the area, the Arab areas, and it almost appears like a domino effect going through the Arab areas, where the something dramatic is taking place. And it is interesting that it is currently focused on Egypt, and focused not just on Egypt, but on this individual, who was one of the last ones that are remaining in power that Mr. Armstrong saw specifically. So I thought what I'd like to do today is to actually go through just examine this Arabic chaos and prophecy, because it fits into prophecy. It's a very important time that we need to be, you know, it's food in due season. I mean, realistically, I felt that having seen what's actually taking place at the moment, and here we are in this beautiful, beautiful day outside. I always remember thinking about the Battle of Britain, when the Battle of Britain was taking place. It was a beautiful summer's day. And yet overhead, there were people dying in their Spitfires during this beautiful summer's day, the days that used to occur at that time. And, you know, we get up and the sun's shining and everything seems perfectly all right. And yet right now, I would imagine that down in Egypt and down in the Arabic countries, some monumental changes are taking place. So what I want to do today, you know, the points I want to go into, I want to talk about Christ's students, because we should be. The disciple, the word disciple means student. And part of that curriculum, if you like, that Christ actually brought us, as was brought out in the radio broadcast earlier on, was the area of prophecy. Secondly, I want to talk about the physical protection, because those students, the servants of God, are to be protected. It again was brought out in the radio broadcast earlier on. And the events that focus in on, as far as the world is concerned, focus around that time of protection. The events cascade down. And thirdly, I want to go into the timing that you find in Daniel, because it's that timing which is crucial. It's that timing that comes right after the prophecy that comes in Daniel 11. And it goes into the timing of the days of Daniel. And it's referring back to that closing time of the king of the north and king of the south. So the timing in Daniel is crucial. And finally, I want to go into the current situation and just point certain things that have taken place, point out certain things that have taken place In the very, very recent past, that you may not have noticed. One particular thing I think is very significant that was in the news about 2 or 3 weeks ago and has only really just taken place, that ties up with this trouble that is going on in Egypt in a way that I think we really do need to be aware of. So those are the areas I want to go into. Those are the four areas I want to deal with. As I say, the whole subject matter is the Arabic chaos and prophecy. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. I mentioned this in the update this week, and certainly we need to be aware of what is going on here in Matthew 5. It begins this section, Matthew 5, 6 and 7. And he says, "And seeing the multitude, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came to him." And notice that. It is his disciples that came to him. These are the students. These are the students that actually came up to him. "And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying..." So this was the natural occurrence, that he would sit, and his students would gather round, and he would then teach them. And in Matthew 5, 6 and 7... you find the teaching of, if you like, the giving of the law as far as the church is concerned. You find the giving of the law at Sinai. In fact, you go back to even the Garden of Eden, you can find the giving of the law as far as Adam and Eve is concerned. Then you find the giving of the law at Sinai. And then you find the re-giving of the law in Deuteronomy as they moved into the Promised Land. But when you come to the church, this section is the giving of the law. And this actually was what I was thinking of talking about today. It was the giving of this giving of the law for the church. But I want you to notice that who he was giving that law to, he was giving it to the disciples, to the students. Now, if we turn over to Matthew 24, and I strongly recommend you put a marker in Matthew 24, because you're going to be flipping back there from time to time through the sermon. But here in Matthew 24, it says in verse 3, and he says, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the students came to him privately, saying, "Tell us when these things shall be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the age." And Jesus answered and said to them. So here again, it was a teaching situation to the students that were there. And if we turn over the page over to John chapter 17, John chapter 17, and that section of Matthew 24 then goes into all these details and into the structure, the time sequence. Very much Matthew 24 is a focal point. It was where Christ himself was teaching the students that he had about prophecy, about what was to come and what was going to lead up to the end of the age, and specifically was mentioned there. But here in John chapter 17, in verse 6, it says, "I've manifest your name." This was his final prayer to the Father before he was actually taken and crucified. "I've manifested your name to the men that you gave me out of the world." So these were specially selected by God. "You know, no man can come to me unless the Father that sends me draws him, and I'll raise him up at the last day." So they were specially selected by God, given to Christ as the living word of God, and then instructed as what? As disciples, as students. And that's what we are today. Those that have heard the word and been able to understand it. And again, the parable of the sower shows this. And in that parable of the sower, in Matthew 13, what's he talking about? He says, "Why do you talk to them in parables?" He says, so that they can't understand. It was so they couldn't understand. But unto you is the keys, as far as the kingdom of God is concerned. And unto the students who were there, to the disciples, he was able to explain and make that plain. "But I have manifested your name," yes, your authority, your government, "to the men which you gave me out of the world, yours they were, and you gave them to me, and they have kept my word," your word. Okay, so it's the word of God that's given to them, and they are therefore able to keep that word. Verse 8, "For I've given to them the words which you gave me, and they've received them, and have known surely that I came from you." But it was the word of God that is given to them. And down in verse 14, "I have given them your word, and that the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. And down in verse 17 it says, sanctify them through your truth. And it's your word that is truth. So the word was going to these students, these disciples, these students, and that was making the distinction between them and the world. And verse 20, neither do I pray for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, taking that same word, this word that we've got here, making it understandable, and having the living Christ, therefore, lead his church. And if you go over to Revelation, Revelation chapter 1, you find a very similar position as far as Revelation is concerned. Now, you think of the apocalypse. The word apocalypse in English means a disaster. But in fact, apocalypse is a Greek word, and it means the revelation. It means to reveal, to make known, to allow people to understand something. But I want you to notice who, in fact, it was to needed to be understanding these things. It says, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show unto his servants the things which were shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John. So we see here, right at the very beginning of Revelation, setting the tone. Who was it actually addressed to? It's addressed to the students, to his servants, to the people of God. And even if you turn back, you're just hitting a few high spots here, turn back to 2 Thessalonians. But in 2 Thessalonians, we're warned here in 2 Thessalonians, there's going to be a distinction that is made. They're talking about the wicked one in verse 8, shall be revealed, who the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. So we're looking at the beast and the false prophet here being mentioned. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all powers, signs, and lying wonders, and hit with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in those that perish or are perishing, or going down a route that is perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth. And what is your word is truth. Remember what we just read in John 17, that they might be saved. But this is the love of the truth that is a vital ingredient and makes the distinction. And so when we're looking at the various prophecies that we'll be looking at today, be aware that these prophecies are being addressed to the students. And we are therefore to be students, students of Christ, disciples, followers, to understand certain things that will shortly come to pass, as it says in the book of Revelation. And so as we look at the events that are taking place in Egypt right at this present time, we don't just look at them as abstract bystanders. It is not just a case that we happen to know something about what's going on. It is the fact that not only are we students of prophecy, we are students of a way of life. We are the same kind of students that you find in Matthew chapter 5 that came to Christ and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, and what he then gave was the spiritual application of God's law. That's the student that needs to understand. And if we get these two separated, because this has happened within the church, and it is still happening within the church, you get people who are bug-eyed about prophecy. But if you get those two things separated, you'll end up thinking you know, but won't know anything at all. That's the difficulty. And that's, we've got to make sure, it's a love of the truth. And a love of the truth is not just the love of prophecy. Yes, the prophecy is part of the truth, but it is not just the love of prophecy. It's the love of all of the things, the word of God. It is a living word of God that we love, that we hold to, and that we are students of. And so as we look at these things, don't, whatever we do, separate out the prophecies from the rest of the spiritual package. Because if we do, it's a meaningless exercise. And we find this so many times throughout the church, unfortunately, today. If we look at this subject of physical protection, and we turn over to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. We find two groups of individuals being mentioned here in Revelation 3 who are going to be around right at the very end time. One is Philadelphia, the other is Laodicea. But here in Revelation 3 verse 10, it says, because you have kept the word of my patience. Notice, you hung on to the word. And what did he say? Your word is truth. And again, it's the truth of God. It's the love. They had a love of the truth. And the ones that don't have lost that love of the truth. But because you've kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of trial that will come upon all the world, or tribulation, the great tribulation, which will come upon all the world to test those that dwell upon the earth. To let them see the radical difference between God's way and man's way. Man's way will produce the tribulation, will cause the tribulation to come about. Behold, I come quickly. You hold on to that, hold that fast which you have. And what's he say that we've got? He says, you kept the word of my patience. You kept that. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take your crown. So that's to one group. And this group is obviously holding on to what has been given to them to do regarding the word of God that has been delivered to them. Unfortunately, the other group, when you look at verse 15, it says, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I would that you were cold or hot, but because you are lukewarm, you're indifferent to this word that's been given to you. And neither cold nor hot, I'll spew you out of my mouth. Because you see, I'm rich, I'm increased with goods, I've got need of nothing, and you don't even see that you're poor, blind, and naked. But here we see two groups contrasted. One holding on to the word, the other despising the word to a large degree. And it says, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I'll spew you out of my mouth. That's the reason why there's going to be one group that is not going to be protected, as opposed to one group that will. And it says, because you kept the word of my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of trial. There's the distinction between these two groups that are there. Now we turn over a few pages in Revelation to Revelation 11. Revelation 11. We find a prophecy here concerning the church, which is where the church is right at this present time. We've been over it over and over again many, many times. But it is a measuring of the temple that takes place. And it's coming right after the section which talks about the word of God being delivered to Israel initially, in the preceding chapter where it talks of the little book, and he said, take it, eat it up, and it'll make your belly bitter, and it'll make your mouth sweet as honey. And he took the book out of the angel's hand, and ate it up, and it was my mouth sweet as honey. It ties it back to the scriptures over in Ezekiel, where the same thing was occurring, and it was a message to Israel. And that message went from Mr. Armstrong to Israel, one of which we just heard. It was a warning message. The gospel should go to all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. That went out to Israel. In addition, he says, you must prophesy again that you many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. And he went to the Shah of Iran. He went to Anwar Sadat. He went to Gandhi. He went to all of these individuals. And he went to Mubarak as well. We've seen all of the others fall very rapidly. But it's been, what, 25 years and more? Mubarak is still there. 30 years he's been in office. Mr. Armstrong went and met him. But it's been 30 years. But now we're on this pivotal time. It looks as if the whole situation, the gap, and what's the gap been for? I was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood and said, measure the temple of God, the altar, and those that worship therein. In other words, look and see the very church itself. Has the church itself changed? Has the church, who is actually in the church? How do you determine these two groups that you find over in Revelation 3? But the court which is outside the temple, leave it out, measure it not, for it's given to the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And this then ties in the 3.5 years. I'll give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. So the next thing that is coming along is 3.5 years, where the two witnesses will be actually prophesying, and they will prophesy all the way through until just before the time of Christ's return. There's your 3.5 years. And it also ties in, it ties in as to what a month is, what a year is. In other words, you're looking at 42 months of 30-day months. So you're looking at the prophetic months, and this is ties in the actual days of Daniel, as we'll go on to see later on. But we see here, when we're looking at Revelation 12, which is an insert chapter, talking about the church and the church's relationship to Satan, we see in verse 13 that when the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she may fly to the wilderness into a place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time. So again, you've got 3.5 years from the face of the serpent. So we're looking at 3.5 years of tribulation, of trouble. Probably it's going to be 2.5 years of the actual tribulation, followed by a year of the day of the Lord. In other words, that's the basic structure that is there. But it's 3.5 years of trouble, one way or another. The 2.5 years brought about by man's misrule. Then you've got the heavenly signs around that time. And then, then you go into the single year, the day of the Lord, which will last for probably about a year. But that's the way in which the structure seems to be implied. But to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she may fly to the wilderness, into a place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time, that's 3.5 years, from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, and Revelation 17:15, if you want to put it in your notes, describes water as people. So people, or an army of some description, goes after them. But very similar to what happened in ancient Egypt, when the army pursued the church in the wilderness and through the Red Sea. In this case, it's the earth that actually helps the woman. And that you may cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, to understand what that means, you can keep your hand in there, but just turn over a couple of pages to Revelation 19, verse 10, when it talks about the testimony of Jesus Christ. But Revelation 19, verse 10, it says here, I fell at his feet to worship, and he said, "Do it not, for I am your fellow servant and of your brethren, and have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy." So here, the individuals, they were keeping the commandments of God, and they had the spirit of prophecy. They had this, they had a knowledge of what was to actually come about, and yet they are not protected. So as I say, it's not just understanding these things that is so vitally important. It is part of the package. It is food in due season that we go over these things. But the contact that we have with God is of vital importance. Absolute, utter vital importance. And as I'll go on and show you, at the time when the Shah of Iran had fallen, when Ayatollah Khomeini had come into power, when the Revolutionary Guards was just starting, when Mr. Armstrong then wrote about the time that we're in now, at that specific time, he coupled it with another article in the same Plain Truth, in the same Good News, rather, about now is the time for fasting and prayer. And it was the two going hand in gloves. He actually ends that article about the time that we're in now with, "It's a time for fasting and prayer." That's his last line. And then gives another article, complete an article, in that same Good News on the same subject. And the time that he was actually looking at that time, was very similar to what you and I saw on the television last night. It was a time of upheaval in the Middle East, within the Arabic areas. And the things that were being dealt with within the Plain Truth, within the Good News, were dealing with situations that we are now seeing, that we are now witnessing again with the one remaining individual that he actually had saw, which was Mubarak. So this is why I say, this is meet and new season. It's essential we look at this and say, hang on a minute, something's going on here. Something should make us all sit up and take notice. And the sitting up and taking notice is not just to say, oh, look into prophecy and let's get our charts out, but let's get our nose into the Bible to understand God's way, God's mindset. Get on our knees, and it also fast as well if we need to fast and get close to God. Because that's the only source of anything. That's the only source of protection that we've got. So when we're looking at protection, physical protection, that physical protection comes from God. All the prophecy in the world will do you no good whatsoever. You can be in contact with whatever group you like, but if you're not in contact with God, you won't be protected. You know, that's as simple as that. And so it is a vital point that we must make sure that this subject goes into its right context. But the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of the seed, who kept the commandments of God and had the spirit of prophecy, because they had the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's where it came from. It came from Jesus Christ, and it is a spirit of prophecy that is being mentioned here. Turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, another one when we're looking at this subject of physical protection, another indication of what will be taking place. But Malachi chapter 3, those that feared the Eternal, in Malachi 3 verse 16, spoke often one with another, and the Eternal listened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him. So it was a case that we are, as one body, we're concerned for one another, we are talking to one another, we are fellowshipping with one another wherever we can, even though we are scattered. It's interesting that this problem in Egypt, one of the major problems was, as far as the authorities are concerned, were two things. One was the internet, and secondly was the mobile phone. Because, I mean, I went over to with one of our grandchildren. We took a few hours off yesterday. And we went over to actually one of these play areas, you know, these play areas they have in industrial units. And in a ball pit, you know, all these plastic balls. And I went in after Karina, and Karina then climbed out, and I was in the middle of the balls. And, of course, Robin got his mobile phone out and took a photograph, and within 30 seconds it had gone to his two sisters and I don't know how many others as well, and now it's probably all over the internet. He's jump balls in the ball pool. So, but that's what's happening down in Egypt, is basically people are seeing something, whipping out their mobile phones, taking a photograph, pressing the button send, then it goes to somebody else who's got access to the internet, and it goes viral. And the authorities try and keep a lid on things. You can't keep a lid on the things, because the reporters are every single individual that's got a mobile phone, and everybody and his dog has got a mobile phone these days. And the mobile phones are then logged into the internet as well. But the benefit of the mobile phone, of the internet, of the communications that we've got, that they feared the Eternal. Notice that feared the Eternal, therefore were wise. The wisdom begins with the fear of the Eternal. These are the wise. These are the ones that are within the church. These are the ones that are the ones that will go and see what that God has a different view of. They spoke often one with another. They used the phone for the right purpose. They used the internet for the right purpose. And the Eternal listened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him of those that feared the Eternal and that thought about his name, that meditated on his authority, on what was going to actually happen, what is happening right now as far as the world is concerned and where that is leading. But it is his authority, his name. And they shall be mine, says the Eternal of hosts, the Eternal of armies, the one who, you know, no army is going to go ahead and defeat. In that day when I make up my jewels, my special treasure, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. So this is another part of the distinction. And the distinction is, then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. It's not just the disciples that came up to Christ on the Mount of Olives and said, when shall these things be and what shall be the sign of your coming? It is the disciples that sat down with him on the Mount and he opened his mouth and taught them, Matthew 5, 6 and 7, which is to do with the law of God and how the spiritual application of that law within modern society and within every single aspect of society. Both areas. It's not, you cannot divorce one from the other. And they shall return and discern between the righteous and wicked, him that serves God and him that serves him not, that's got the Spirit of God by getting on his knees each day with fasting and prayer. That is what's needed, what's necessary. And if you go to Matthew 24, where you've all got your markers in verse 20, it says, you pray that your flight is not going to be on the winter, nor the Sabbath day, for then shall be great tribulation, great trial, such as was not since the beginning of the world, to this time, no, nor ever shall be. So there's only one time that's going to be like it. And it talks about a flight at that time. It talks about being removed. And some people have said that there's going to be 3.5 years of famine. What we find in Ezekiel, about a third of the population die, and we're not going to be fleeing until after the 3.5 years of famine. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Because, quite frankly, if a third of the population die, that is the tribulation. That's part of the tribulation. We may have to do without. There's no question of that. It may be very difficult times. In fact, it will be very difficult times just before we flee. But as it says here, it says, then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world, to this time, no, ever shall be. And unless the days shall be shortened, there'll be no flesh saved alive. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So we should, to take hope of this and understand what God is actually saying. Remember, who is it being taught? Who is it being said to? Well, the disciples came to him privately, notice, saying, and again, no man shall come to me unless the Father that sends me draws him, and I'll raise him up the last day. It is reserved for the church to understand this. And if we are to understand this, we've got to make sure that we're on our knees, that we're doing what is necessary spiritually, because that is where it's really that is what is really important. Now, as far as the timing in Daniel is concerned, here in Matthew 24, in verse 15, it says, therefore, when you will see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, that means reading Daniel now, let him understand. Then let them that were in Judea flee to the mountains, and let him that is on the housetop not go down, and so on. So, the abomination that makes desolate, when that actually occurs, and whoever reads Daniel, let him understand, then is the time to flee. Then is the time that you've got to get out of Jerusalem, certainly, and you flee to the mountains. Now, if, as Mr. Armstrong has said many times, that if God gives an indication of where the place of safety is, it is Petra. If it's not Petra, then we have no clue, except that it is a place of the mountains, it's a place of the rock. But if it's not Petra, then we don't know. But whatever it is, we flee to the mountains at that time. Let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now, the mountains from Judea. Judea is about, Jerusalem, for instance, is about, 3,500 feet above sea level. The mountains, you've got to go down into the Jordan Valley, which is 1,000 feet below sea level, so you drop 4,500 feet. And then you go across the Allenby Bridge into Jordan, and then you go up into the Jordan, and there's your mountains. It's the mountains that are on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. And that's the area where you go down then to Petra as well. So that's the... it's interesting that when we'll go on and we'll see the timing as far as Daniel is concerned, the days of Daniel, and you're looking at 30 days from the time of the abomination that makes desolate to the time the tribulation starts, from the 1290 to the 1260. And you know, you're looking at the age of the church these days, and the wheelchairs that are around, and you can see it taking 30 days to go from... I mean, I walked from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is downhill virtually all the way, 4,500 feet down. I did that in how many hours? We set off early in the morning, and then we got there about midday. So it wasn't that difficult a walk by any stretch. As far as understanding that abomination that makes desolate, Mr. Armstrong actually mentioned about the abomination in the booklet, The Middle East in Prophecy. And he gives the abomination of desolation, and he mentions about Antiochus, and he then goes into the understanding that we had at that time. So there's slightest shadow of doubt, this abomination that makes desolate, it was an idol set up in 167 BC by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now that understanding changed. That was actually written in 1948 initially, but the understanding there changed. And in the article in the Good News of January 1980, he says, but verse 11, from the time the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, he talks about not a material temple to be built in our time in Jerusalem, but it does seem to imply that the Israelis may restore the daily, twice daily sacrifice. And he goes on, he says, some commentators have interpreted it as talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and the abomination, have interpreted it as Antiochus placing a statue of Jupiter in the Holy of Holies in the temple. Not only does Matthew 24:15 also refer to this, but in a parallel, New Testament Luke 21:20 speaks of the same thing as Jerusalem compassed with armies, and this is the correct meaning of this abomination. It's the armies, not a statue, that makes Jerusalem desolate. So even though this booklet was going out still, Middle East in Prophecy, there were certain things within it that were not correct, that had been actually corrected by Mr. Armstrong. And what we need to do to understand the timing as far as Daniel is concerned, where it says here in Matthew 24, verse 15, when you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, reads Daniel, let him understand. Let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. You can see that there. You then turn over to Luke 21. And we find that when you shall see, verse 20, and it says, it's interesting, it says 19, in your patience possess you your souls. It says, because you've kept the word of my patience. And it's a case of we have got to be patient until the coming of Christ. You know, we never thought we'd be here. I never thought I'd be aged in my 60s with grandchildren. I mean, it's unthinkable as far as I'm concerned. And yet we are. We're still here. In your patience possess you your souls, verse 19. And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh, and let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. So it's the same thing being talked of. One describes it as the abomination that makes desolate. The other one, it describes what it is, and it is the armies that are surrounding Jerusalem. It doesn't mean to say it's got to have the same thing that happened under Antiochus and be a statue of Jupiter Olympus that is erected in some physical temple. It doesn't have to have a physical temple, because Christ is returning to a spiritual temple. But it does, as we'll read again, imply that there's going to be some kind of an altar built. So there's going to be some kind of thinking towards the end of a physical temple that's going on, which there is right now, but it'll go another stage further to have the morning and the evening sacrifices being offered on an altar of some description. Now, if we go back to Daniel, and we turn over to Daniel 12. We find here in Daniel chapter 12, it says in verse 10, it says, many shall be purified and made white and tried, But the wicked will do wickedly, and it's interesting again what is happening right at this present time, this time where it talks about Luke 21 saying, in patience possess your souls. It's talking in Revelation 11, it's talking about measuring the temple and testing and being tried and tested. And that is exactly where we are today. And it is, again, because you kept the word of my patience, I'll keep you from the hour of trial. Hold that fast that you have, that no man take your crown. And it says here, many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked will do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand. Now it talks about, he who reads Daniel, let him understand. So we're immediately talking in the same context, and the context was the abomination that makes desolate, and it's being mentioned in verse 11 of this Daniel 12. So you see here, many shall be purified and the wicked shall be do wickedly, none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Now, we can, we'll read there as well. Again, if you've got another marker somewhere, I don't know how many markers you've got, but another finger sticking in here in Matt and Daniel, because we'll be coming back there shortly. But if you turn back to Psalm 111, again, this wisdom and this understanding is defined within Scripture, and here in Psalm 111, it's interesting. It's quite an interesting psalm because it starts one aspect in the first part of a verse, and then gives a kind of like a mirror aspect, and gives the spiritual implication in the second half. It says, "Praise the Eternal, and I'll praise the Eternal with my whole heart," and then the second aspect. In the assembly, or the church of the upright, and in the church, in the congregation, or in the church, the works of the Eternal are great, sought out of all. Notice, and then on the other side, it's sought out of all those that have pleasure therein. In other words, they have a love of the truth, sought out by those that have a love of the truth. So the works of the Eternal that are so great, His work is honourable and glorious. And the other side. And his righteousness endures forever. So if you've got his righteousness, that will go on into eternity. He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. And what's the other side? And the Eternal is gracious and full of compassion. This is the mind of God again. So you've got a kind of like a physical on one side and a spiritual on the other, constantly throughout the psalm. He's given food to those that fear him, meat to those that fear him. And he will be ever mindful of his covenant, of his agreement, and the new covenant. As far as, again, remember, we're talking about prophecy, yes, but we're talking about the disciples, the students, and the students of a new covenant, a new agreement. What was attacked within the apostasy? It was the covenant, the new covenant. It was perverted and twisted. But that was the new covenant that you find in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. He's shown his people the power of his works, that he may give them the heritage of the nations, of the heathen. So there's what he's aiming for, as far as the kingdom of God is concerned. The works of his hands are truth and judgment. All his commandments are sure. You hang on to the commandments. They stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness. He sent his redemption to his people. He has commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name, which is why we do not call ministers reverend. Because he is one, holy and reverend. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. That's how you get wisdom. A good understanding have all those that do his commandments, and his praise endures forever. But that's where you look, that is what we're looking at. When we're looking over back here in Daniel, many will be purified and white and tried, and the wicked will do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise... who are doing what? Fearing the Eternal. What do we find in Malachi? Fear of the Eternal, thought often on his name. And you start putting all these scriptures together and you start seeing a picture of the church. Of the church which is the true church. What we should be doing as a true church. And how we should be acting and behaving as a true church. And it therefore, what is going on currently in Egypt becomes very meaningful indeed. You see that as being fit within what we've been living through. In patience possess your souls. you know, because you kept the word of my patience and the patience over these last 25 years that we've been waiting for these things to actually take place. Now, here in Daniel 12, we find in verse 1, it says, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of his feet, your people. And there'll be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at the same time your people shall be delivered. So here is the time of tribulation. And we find the tribulation mentioned here, we find it mentioned in many other passages of Scripture, a time which is unique in history, a time of trouble that is unique in history. And verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. So, and what are we in today? We are in today a time when rioters can go ahead and pull their mobile phones out, take themselves a picture, push it on the internet, and it can go viral. We are even to the point where, you know, you can go out, we go out yesterday afternoon, or morning it was, wasn't it, and just for the fun of it, you know, take a picture, stick it out to the rest of the family, and you always think nothing of it. You know, this is the way things are. I think the iPhone has got two cameras, hasn't it? You've got one on the front, one on the back, so you can play with it using Skype. But this Michael shall stand up, and there'll be a time of trouble such as never was from as a nation. And it says, you go and seal the book, verse 4, to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro. Communications of this type that has never been seen before. The viral nature of the mobile phone is part of that communications. It's not just jumping on a plane and being able to be in New York in a few hours' time. It's the fact that I can sit at my computer and I can be in New York in a few milliseconds. I can actually operate a machine in New York, in San Francisco, in wherever, and operate it through the telephone lines, through the internet. Money shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. We have, you know, the knowledge that is involved. You think of the cars that we drive today compared to the cars and the vehicles of my father was a haulage contractor. The vehicles that he had were very much different from the electronic things that we've got today. Very different. The knowledge shall be increased. And in verse 7, and I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand. It says in verse 6, it says, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Now, so we're looking at the end of the wonders. Now, what's the end of the wonders? Well, the end of the wonders, notice, it says verse 13, but you go your way till the end be, for you shall rest and stand in your lot at the end of the days. Talking to Daniel. Now, we know that the resurrection occurs at the last trump, when Christ returns. So at the last trump, as the trumpet begins to sound, so it's the beginning of the last trump, before the plagues actually occur, which occur within that last trump, before that actually happens, right at the beginning of the last trump, that's when the resurrection occurs, and that's when Daniel will stand in his lot at the end of the days. So he says, how long shall it be, in verse 6, to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left to heaven, and he swore by him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, 3.5 years. And you look at a prophetic year as 360 days, 12 times 30, and you're looking at 1,260 days altogether. And that's how the 1,260 days comes in. And when he shall accomplish this, well, better translation, and when the shattering of the holy people comes to an end, all these things will be accomplished. That's the RSV. And so it appears that it's probably talking about the shattering coming to an end at the time that these 1,260 days and all the days of Daniel then start. And there's going to be, because the church is recognized as a single body. Today it's a shattered body. Today the church is shattered to the four winds. When the two witnesses rise up, there's going to be a time when, you know, it'll be clear. We will know that the church will in fact, Zion will be built at that time. And every indication seems to be, as far as I can see anyway, seems to point to the fact that the church will, the shattering will come to an end at the beginning of these days. And I heard, but I didn't understand, and I can imagine he didn't understand. Then I said, "Oh my Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" He said, "Look, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed and are sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, and the wicked will do wickedly, but they shall not understand, but the wise shall understand." And we've gone through that. "And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days." So at the time when Jerusalem is going to be surrounded by armies, that's the abomination that makes desolate, that time the sacrifice, the evening and morning sacrifice, will be taken away. "Blessed is he that waits," from that point of time there'll be 1,290 days. So you've got 1,260 to the end of the, well, as it says in verse 13, "Go your way, shall you rest and stand in your lot," at the end of the day. So from the return of Christ and the resurrection, you go back 1,260. You come to a point where the tribulation starts. You go back from the return of Christ to 1,290, which is 30 days before the 1,260, and you come to a point where the abomination that makes desolate, that's Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that's the sacrifice being taken away. So the sacrifice is going to be set up some other time before that. And again, from the time of the return of Christ, it says in verse 12, "Blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days. You go back 1,335, which is 45 days before the abomination that makes desolate. And there you come to a blessing that is mentioned. So these are the days of Daniel. And the thing is, that what's he talking about? Basically, and Daniel says, verse 4, "But you, O Daniel, shut up your words, seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." And he says, "Go your way, for the words are closed and sealed to the time of the end," in verse 9. Which words? Well, it's the preceding prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. This is being given as far as the king of the north and the king of the south. And this is where we come into the current situation that we find ourselves in today. The reason why I'm giving this sermon today, rather than the sermon I was thinking of giving, is because this passage, this end of Daniel 11, is an important area of scripture. And it is a dual, it's dual in its nature. And in verse 32, if we pick it up in verse 32 and just go through it very quickly, noticing the dual aspects of its nature. "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they," that's the many that are instructed incidentally, "shall fall by the sword and by flames." Remember, we're talking about Mr. Armstrong when he went out and he about the little book that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 10. And you're looking at the instruction, one of which we've just heard now, again. That instruction went out to millions of people. And yet they shall fall, that's the ones that heard it, shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and spoil many days. And the focal point, I mean, certainly as far as the ship stations were concerned here, it was going to the teenagers. It was going to the young 20s, but normally the teens. And so you're looking at this 60s generation that is the ruling generation today. "Now when they shall fall, they'll be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall." So we're looking again Laodicea that is going to have to go through the tribulation. "To try them and to purge and to make them white even to the time of the end." So it's not just the time looking back at Antiochus Epiphanes. This is a dual application, and it goes now further and further into the time of the end. "Because it is yes for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every God, and shall speak marvellous things against the God of gods, and prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he will magnify himself above all." This is the beast power now. This is the and beast power. For in his estate shall he honour the God of forces, and a God that his fathers knew not, shall he honour with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God that he shall acknowledge, and increase with glory, and he will cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Now this is talking about this European leader that is going to be arising. But what we've got to make sure we understand is that all the time we felt that the Europe would arise and attack the United States and be as an outside force. What we need to understand that we also thought that the attack onto the church would be from an outside force that would attack the church from outside. But it didn't happen that way. It came from inside and it came from the top. And if you look at the prophecies in the end, towards the end of Matthew 24, we need to be aware of this fact, that it could come from inside, from the top, in the same way as it came within the church. And I'm not saying it will, I'm just saying we've got to be aware that that's the case. Because building up the armaments here that is being talked about, these armaments, are they going to be built up by Germany? If so, you're looking at down, you know, decades probably to build the kind of armaments being mentioned here. But if it came from the inside, from the top, and the armaments of the United States at the moment were taken over by the beast power, you've then got all the armaments you need. It could happen, you know, in a very short order. And this is why I say we do not need to... The difficulty is, looking at it the way we looked at it in the past, it pushes the date of Christ's return back. But if you look at it coming from the inside, from the top, where the beast power then seizes control of the armaments that are already there, you then can see this happening in short order. So this shall he do with the most strongholds, with a strange God that he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he'll cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships, and he'll enter into the countries and overflow and pass over. So there you see the king of the north coming down it says in verse 41, and he shall also enter into the glorious land. So he's entering into Palestine, he's entering into Jerusalem. There's your armies that are going to surround Jerusalem. There's your indication of the abomination that makes desolate, the 1,290 days, and the time that the church will be warned at 1,335 days. But 1,290, they've got to flee for their lives. We've got to flee for our lives. They'll enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, the chief of the children of Ammon. So we've got Turkey and Syria and Jordan. And he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So Egypt will be taken over. Egypt will be overrun. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and of all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his step. Now, reading that, you think, well, it's Ethiopia at his steps. Well, no, the word isn't Ethiopia. It's Cush, the Cushites. Now, when we're looking at Cush, Cush was the father of Nimrod. He was the son of Ham. But Cush married Semiramis, and they had a son called Nimrod, who Semiramis then married. And that was the family tree, if you like, the very convoluted family tree of Cush and Nimrod. But the Cushites were black, Semiramis was white, and Nimrod was half and half. But anyway... When we're looking here, where it mentions here, the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be in his steps. The Libyans are the word actually literally means the dry people. It's the people that live in the dry areas. The Tuaregs and these other areas into the desert areas would be all part of that. So he could well establish his force all the way along the top of North Africa and down into Egypt, and it will then, the boundary will be at the the dry people, whoever is inhabiting the arid areas of the Sahara, and then south down to the start of the black areas. Now, this is why I say, let's see, what we've already read about the Middle East in prophecy and how certain things have actually changed in regard to Antiochus Epiphanes. The Middle East in prophecy also talks about the King of the South at the end time and ties it across to Ethiopia. It ties it across to the invasion of Ethiopia by King Menelik. King Menelik of Ethiopia sent an army of 9,000 to 10,000 men against the Italian army. And it talks about how the Italians then went down with a great deal of force and attacked. So the King of the South pushed out Mr. Armstrong when he saw this happening in 1948, the time, around that time. He saw the King of the South pushing at the King of the North coming down against him. But what we've got to understand is that at the same time as Mr. Armstrong was witnessing the Iranian problems at that time, and writing in the Good News of January 1980, about the time we're in now, and mentioning areas of prophecy where about the daily sacrifice. He actually mentions here, he says, verse 11, from the time the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, consider this a moment, it does not imply a material temple to be built in our time in Jerusalem. It does seem to imply the Israelis may restore the daily, twice daily sacrifices by the Wailing Wall, possibly, and the indication the armies of the beast entering Jerusalem will stop the daily sacrifice. And it says, the abomination that makes desolate, they set up, what's the abomination? And then he goes and explains, it's Jerusalem compassed with armies. Now, in this Middle East in prophecy, it has a different explanation. So even though this was still available, he had made modifications to that. At the same time as that was happening, there was also another article in the Plain Truth of December 79, so the month before the Good News of 1980, which was coming from Keith Stump, and he mentioned, he says, who is the King of the South? In the earlier portions of Daniel 11, the phrase refers without question to ancient Egypt under the rule of the Ptolemaic dynasty, later including Ethiopia, which was an annexed to Egypt. But in verse 40, we skip to the time of the end. This present century, this is verse 40 now of here, where at the time of the end shall the King of the South push at him. So it says, this verse undoubtedly found at least partial fulfillment in the offensive in 1896 of Menelik II of Ethiopia, King of the South, against the Italian armies of King Humbert I, King of the North, and in the air, land and sea invasion of Ethiopia 40 years later by Mussolini's forces. But Mussolini did not finish the prophecy. He did not, for example, enter the glorious land or Palestine, verse 41. Its greater fulfillment is yet future. So this is why Egypt right now and the problems in Egypt are very important. Just as there is yet to be a final king of the north called in Bible symbolism the beast, who will arise as a super dictator over an end-time European confederation, there may very well emerge in the same manner a final king of the south, an overall leader of an Arab-Muslim confederation, possibly even bearing the very title of Mahdi. Now this is what we're looking for. If we're looking for anything coming out of Egypt and coming out of the troubles that are actually occurring, it is, we've got to keep our eyes open for some kind of Mahdi-like figure. And these two individuals will eventually find themselves in a head-to-head confrontation, possibly over oil, which will ultimately lead to a devastating war in the Middle East. Now, that was written at the same time as this other article was written, the time we're in now. It's around about that same period of time, which was when Iran was going through its problems, when the Shah had been deposed. Iran and the problems that were happening at that time prompted Mr. Armstrong to write this article. And at the same time, on page 2 of the same Good News, he goes into the fact that the time has come for fasting and prayer. And he gives a whole article on the fact that the time has come for fasting and prayer. And he ends this section on the time that we are in now with the phrase, or the last two paragraphs, the whole world is now on fire. This is not the Great Tribulation, but it is certainly preliminary to it. It is time for intensive fasting and prayer. So again, when we're looking at the spiritual heritage that we've been given, we've got to go back to not just the prophecies, but the attitude of mind and the frame of mind that was there at that time, and the way and the approach that is needed. And the time is a time for fasting and prayer. And so what we're looking at, when we're looking at this period of time that we find ourselves in today, and we're looking at this Arab world in prophecy, the fact that at that time, when they saw the Shah of Iran, Anwar Sadat eventually was murdered later on, but Haile Selassie had been deposed a few years before, and all these individuals Mr. Armstrong had seen. But now we see Mubarak going through exactly the same kind of process as the Shah of Iran went through. And so it's almost like the closing of a chapter. It's almost like this was the last one that was left. There's himself and also the King of Thailand. These two individuals. And the last closing of the doors of these elderly men that had actually met with Mr. Armstrong. So it is interesting that when you're looking at the events that are happening at the moment, you look at the weather that's going on. And the weather that's taking place. Look at the weather. I mean, we've had to help people down in Kenya. But you look at, apparently down in Sydney at the moment, I had a report come in to me from, in fact, you can be remembering the people down in Sydney. Because in Sydney, this report was that they were actually having to sleep in the living room because of the intense heat that is there. They were sleeping in the living room with the air conditioning on. Because the intense heat that is there, and again the floods that they've had have devastated the grain crop over in that area. You're looking at the problems they've had in India and Pakistan as far as the floods are concerned, and you're seeing the weather affecting many areas of the country of the earth. And as far as the food supply is concerned, you are seeing a real problem with food supplies. And I don't think it's the end famine that we're looking at this particular time, but it's certainly part of the birth pains that you find mentioned in the beginning of Matthew 24, and you find as far as the seals, the first four seals, the first four horsemen of the apocalypse. I've already mentioned about the mobile phone cameras and the spread of ideas. The ideas as far as the Mahdi, let me just read something. Because it's not just the Christians, the scriptures that have prophecies in there. It's not just the Catholics that have prophecies and the calendar? Anyway, you know what I mean. You know what I mean. The calendar over in South America. Maya calendar. But there's not just that. Let me just read something from the prophecies that they've got in Islam. It says, according to the tradition, Imam Ali, and this, by the way, is from Forbes, Forbes.com, from an article that was written back in October 2008, when Mr. Obama was actually going for presidency. According to the tradition, Imam Ali Ibn Ab Talib, and I'm not going to say that again, the prophet's cousin and son-in-law, so Muhammad's prophet's cousin and son-in-law, he prophesied that at the end of times, and just before the return of the Mahdi, and it's interesting, you know, when you look at what actually took place when Muhammad got his prophecies, he should never have listened to his uncle. Because Muhammad was right, his assessment was right, but his uncle dissuaded him from his assessment. Because Muhammad said that a demon had been speaking to him, And his uncle said, oh no, it's not a demon, it's an angel. So he twisted his mind and so on. So it wasn't just Muhammad that was involved in this religion sprouting up. It was also the prophet's cousin and son-in-law as well, who prophesied that at the end of times and just before the return of the Mahdi, notice, the ultimate saviour, a quote, tall black man will assume the reins of government in the West. And this is an Islamic prophecy. Commanding, quote, the strongest army on earth, unquote. The new ruler in the West will carry, quote, a clear sign from the third imam, whose name was Hussein ibn Ali. The tradition concludes, quote, Shiites should have no doubt that he is with us. This is all part of the prophecy. In a curious coincidence, Obama's first and second names, Barack Hussein, mean the blessing of Hussein in Arabic and in Persian. His family name Obama, written in the Persian alphabet, reads O-ba-ma, which means, quote, he is with us. The magic formula of the tradition. So again, pure coincidence? Well, even if it was pure coincidence, it has a bearing on what we're seeing on our television screens in regard to what's happening in Egypt. These kind of traditions will, you know, for a Mahdi-like figure to arise. It's a prelude. You know, here is this black, tall black man who is in the most powerful nation on earth, all mentioned within the Islamic writings. And the other thing, I mean, let me read you another article. This is from the Daily Telegraph today. Literally, it was in the article. In fact, what you've got here, this is today's Telegraph. Excuse the thing on the side there. But America's secret backing for rebel leaders behind Egyptian uprising. WikiLeaks revelation comes as the troops and rioters clash on the streets of Cairo. It says the American government secretly backed leading figures behind the Egyptian uprising who have been planning regime change for the past 3 years, the Daily Telegraph has learned. The American embassy in Cairo helped a young dissident attend a US-sponsored summit for activists in New York while working to keep his identity secret from the Egyptian state police. So the Americans have actually been involved in actually supporting this reaction. And yet, inside the paper, you see the other side of the coin, the other side that, you know, you don't tend to notice. It seems incredible to me that they don't realise what was really likely to happen. It says, this is from Dark Forces Lurk in the Shadows of Hope by Hilia Abrahimi. And as you go on and see that this lady is a Persian. It says, the unfolding tide of revolution in the Arab world is a bittersweet moment that is bound to open the tinderbox of Islamic fundamentalism. The downfall of 30 years of oppressive rule and a people's uprising should create a sense of hope. But as a Persian, born in an early period of revolution, the prospect leaves me stone cold scared. This is not the Berlin Wall, and what is waiting on the other side is not West Germany. And this is the problem. It goes on, it says, at first it may be presented as a return to nationalism and a rejection of westernization, but the end game is an Islamic state. For my parents' generation, this led to the exodus of millions of Iranians after the 1978 revolution. The Iranian revolution had many of the hallmarks of today's Egypt. The Shah of Iran was the corrupt despot. He had lined his pockets, was ruthless against political opposition, was seen by his subject as a puppet of the West. When the young took to the streets 32 years ago, they thought they were signing up for a new era where they would be able to determine their own future. But the youth were superseded by another group who were kept in check by the Shah, the clerics. Just as Mubarak today keeps the Muslim Brotherhood, the radical side of the Muslim faith, under control. So it's not just keeping the students under control, it's keeping the clerics under control. And the students rise up to get freedom, just the same as it happened in Shah of Iran, and you suddenly find yourself with something very different indeed. It says, within months, the revolution unleashed the Islamic Republic. Faith is never a bad thing, and it has a simple appeal. Ordinary people who are tired of poverty and the opulent lifestyles of the old guard can easily be swayed by the wholesome values of religion. It is a miserable fate that the choice has to be between self-enriching despots and controlling clerics who want power over every aspect of life. But alas, it's all I've ever seen in my lifetime. So that is from somebody who's lived through it as a young child and seen her parents have to flee from Iran and seen the results of what is now taking place in Egypt. And so we are actually witnessing a time which, when you go back to what Mr. Armstrong was writing about in the Good News, in the Plain Truth and so on, in these articles, it's the same time. It's the last person that is left of the people that he actually went out and saw. Mubarak is just appears about ready to fall. So we ask ourselves, well, what's the state of play? Well, here, in Daniel 11, it says, he will stretch forth his hand in verse 42 upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He will have trials over the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps, or the Cushites shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and of the north, now that's coming from Russia, and the communist areas going over through Russia from China, shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And this we've always taken to destroy the actual Ephraim and Manasseh. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, and he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So he'll actually put his headquarters in Jerusalem. And there are other prophecies that mention how long he'll be there for. 1,200, let's have a look. No, that's not the one I want. I didn't put a note in my notes, but there is a section that gives him how many days he'll be there for. He will actually move after so many, I can't remember exactly what the number of days are, but he will move from that area before the end, before Christ's return. He'll actually move and it'll go back to Judah again. I want to just draw your attention, however, and I want you to go and zero in a little bit about the fact that the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be his steps. The Libyans are those who are in the dry areas, and also the Cushites will be at his step. Something else has taken place in the last few weeks, which has been incredibly significant in regard to this, which also needs to be put into the equation and to be understood in the equation. And remember, what we're looking at is the king of the north coming down against this king of the south. The king of the south, having pushed at him, is coming out of some kind of a Mahdi-like individual within the Arabic areas, within the Islamic areas. Now, what has happened? I mean, if somebody was to say to you, which is the biggest country in Africa? What would you say? Congo or whatever? But it wouldn't be the Congo. It's not the Congo. It's the Sudan. The Sudan is the biggest country in Africa. It's also the biggest country in the Arab lands, in the Islamic lands. The Sudan is the equivalent in size to Germany, France, Italy, Poland, Spain, Greece, and the United Kingdom combined. It is an enormous country. It is huge. And the thing is that has just happened recently is they had it's talking about Ethiopia. It's talking not about Ethiopia that we know today. It's talking about the Cushites being at his steps. What has happened is had a referendum that is about to split that country, not in half, but to split the southern part of that country. The southern part is Christian or animist. It is African. It is Cushite. The northern part is Islamic. It is Arabic in its nature. And could it be that the steps that are being talked about here, could it be that the Cushite area is going to be southern part of the Sudan? Because that's a Christian area. Ethiopia, that's a Christian area. But when you come to the northern part, there's the Islamic area. And again, I throw it out for what it's worth. It says, the south occupies an area the size of France, but it is just 38 miles of paved road. It's incredibly poor. By breaking ties with the north, it risks making the economic plight even more perilous. The world's 193rd state, suggested names of the new Sudan, Equatorial and the Nile Republic, would almost certainly be the most impoverished. So that southern one which, and over 90% of the people, about 99% of the people that went to the referendum, chose to go ahead and separate. So it's almost a foregone conclusion that this is going to take place. As many diplomats are warning, secession will make life worse for the majority of people in southern Sudan, why are they so keen on separation? The answer lies in the uncompromising approach of the Arabized government in Khartoum has adopted towards non-Muslims. Since independence in 1956, the southerners have invariably been treated as serfs by their Muslim overlords, who often sought to starve them into submission when they complained. Unworryingly, the seemingly irreparable rift between Sudan's Christian and Muslim communities is being replicated in many parts of the Arab world, where the growing intolerance of Islamic hardliners has led to an alarming escalation in violence against Christians. In Iraq, extreme Al-Qaeda attacks against Christians have seen a community that numbered about 1.5 million at the time of Saddam Hussein's overthrow in 2003 reduced to 400,000. This exodus has increased considerably since the appalling attack on the Church of Our Saviour in Baghdad in the end of last year, which killed 58 worshippers. In a grotesque demonstration of their contempt for the Christian faith, the suicide bombers blew themselves up on an altar along with a child hostage. You know, this is the kind of thing that's been going on, and this is the kind of thing that is being seen in the West, being seen in the Vatican. That's where it's being seen. The bombing of the New Year of a church at the port of Alexandria has had a similarly devastating impact on Egypt's 8 million Copts, who comprise 10% of the country's population. Al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq have been blamed for the attack, which killed 21 worshippers. Much of the blame of the deterioration in relations between the faiths lies with the growing legion of Islamic militants who seek to wage jihad against the West. But the origins of Islamic intolerance to other faiths, particularly Judaism and Christianity, can be traced back to the Prophet himself. On his deathbed, he instructed followers that only one faith, Islam, could be allowed in Arabia. Christianity remains banned in Saudi Arabia, which claims to be closely allied to the West, and Christians are not allowed to visit the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, where the Prophet lived and preached. Last year, 12 Filipinos and a priest were arrested for proselytism after they held a secret mass in Rida. So this is going on. This is causing a problem. And this is, you can see, therefore, the arising of a Mahdi. He says, for many Christians, the ability to enjoy a peaceful coexistence with the Muslim neighbours is but a distant memory. And that was in the Telegraph of about two or three weeks ago. But the Sudan is splitting. At the same time as you now see what's happening in Egypt, you see Egypt under absolute anarchy at the moment. You see Egypt being riven in the same way as what happened in Iran in years gone by. And we also can go back to the same kind of writings that Mr. Armstrong had at that time. And we can see the similarity between 79-80 and what we're seeing today with the Shah. So please do go back and read the good news of January 1980. Go and look it up somewhere and read it. Read that article, the time we're in. But don't stop there. We also must make sure we also go on to page 2 as well, because that's the vital part of the same equation that we see on our television screens at the moment, and that is that the time has come now for fasting and prayer.